the 9th of May, and oh boy, it's the end of the semester. It's coming at us at blinding speed. When's the final? When's the final? Everyone should say 23rd. When's the final? 23rd. Thursday. There's no class that Tuesday because it's finals week. So please get in touch with me if you're not going to make it, because after that, poof, it's over. You ain't going to be no makeups. So get in touch with me. Because it's gone. I have to get the grades in. 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. I know you're going to watch something. You're going to show up at 9:30. I will stick around until at least noon to make sure everybody gets here. Two pages of notes, calculator, Scantron, constant perpetual discounted cash flow, bond pricing, and you get to use Chapter 6 and Chapter 10 formula sheets in addition to the two pages of notes. Now, yes. Now, is it cumulative?
Yes.
There will be general questions, the same kind of questions we've been getting all semester long about stocks, bonds, mutual funds, short-term investments, asset allocation, and then specific questions about options and futures, shorting and margining, which we're going to go over today. There will be no calculations on options, no calculations on margining or shorting. And for that reason, there was a collective disconnect on Tuesday when all these were discussed. I'm not going to learn this. I'm not going to learn it. You're not going to make me pee-pee. You're not going to make me take calculations. I'm not going to learn it. So what I'm going to do today, if anybody screams and hollers, please, you don't have to do it. You don't even do it publicly. You can send me an email if you don't think it's an idea. We only have two more classes. So today we're going to do margining and shorting, and we're going to just skim through. If we have any time at the end of class, we'll go take a look at some of the exercises that you will see on the Series 7. But again, I'm not going to make you do them. That's today. On Tuesday, then, we'll do real estate, gold, and other investment alternatives, along with 401ks, 403bs, Roth IRAs, and regular accounts. And then we'll have Baffle the Broker. I didn't want to jettison Baffle the Broker. Normally we take 2 days for margining and shorting, 1 day for margining and then the next day for shorting. But after the options debacle on Tuesday, when you guys went like this and looked at me like, oh, I messed up, I said, all right, well, why don't we do that today? Any complaints, any thoughts, any comments?
Which happens to be the focus on?
Well, specific questions will be about shorting, margining, options, futures, and then just a couple of questions about real estate, gold, other investments. Just a couple of general questions. Yes?
Well, this actually
a good assignment. It's worth a little bit more than a regular exam. Don't worry about the final. Don't cram all night long because you just come here and go like see students taking no dos and drinking monster drinks and all these other try to stay awake. What?
I know.
Is that the way to learn?
Yeah.
No, it's not. Yeah. It isn't. You don't learn that way. The way to learn is through repetition. Every day studying. Peanut butter. What did he say?
Peanut butter.
I have never heard that in my life. Peanut butter. Yeah, I never talked to Victor about it. Okay. So I passed out, as I remember, the buying and selling securities handout. If you weren't here on Tuesday, this is the buying and selling. Pass a few of those back. I gave you one already, so just pass it back. Anybody not here on Tuesday? This group? Okay. Pass that back, Anna. All right, so let's get started on buying and selling securities. But first, we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? What? Google a joke? I don't know, what should I start? We can't do this. Did I tell you the Microsoft joke?
Yeah.
I did. Okay, how about the two antennas? This is one of my favorite. People hate this. The two antennas were, all right, maybe I should tell you the other guy's joke. What was that? What do you say? When do you congratulate a person who's just made a very big mistake? I told you that one?
At the reception.
That's good. Oh, you were here on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, so these two antennas met on a rooftop and fell in love. Did you hear this one before?
No.
They fell. It's a very heartwarming story. So they got married. They were so in love, they got married. And we were invited. Two antennas got married. Yeah. Probably another antenna. anyway, so we went to the wedding. The ceremony was kind of boring, but the reception was brilliant.
Wow.
Isn't that bad? Oh, I really love bed.
First Tuesday now that.
I have people go, I need a bed. Okay, so, yes.
Well, you told your wife, she's a joke.
No. But, yeah, she's... She hasn't said it in a long time, but no, she hates. she likes the Italian jokes. I told you, didn't I tell you?
Italian,
yeah. Well, because I'm Italian, so I can tell Italian jokes. Like all my
grandparents.
Yeah, with that accent, of course. I grew up in Philadelphia, South Philly, Rocky. So, why it is we Italians don't like Jehovah's Witnesses, huh? You know why? Because we Italians don't like any witnesses. I told that to a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses who knocked on our door, and they looked at me and said, no, you're going to like it. It's not against Jehovah's Witnesses. I got a joke if you don't like it. And they looked at me and they laughed. They said, oh, that's funny. We're going to tell the folks that I get the whole. Okay. Yeah, oh, it's a great joke. I love it. But see, I'm allowed to tell it. Because I'm Italian. If you're not Italian, you're not allowed to tell it. See, there was one guy, he passed away a couple years ago, but his name was John Cunningham. And he used to tell jokes and write cartoons about disabled people. And, oh, right, is that a hot button issue? Until it turns out that he was in a wheelchair. And then it was okay. And they interviewed him and said, well, don't you think it's kind of odd that you're allowed to tell jokes about disabled people and nobody else? Because I think it's great. His best one is there's a broken down wheelchair in the desert, and there's this line of sand going off into the desert, and the posse just caught up to him and says, don't worry, he won't get far on foot. Ooh, that one got a lot of people angry. But he got away with it. Okay, so today it's going to be a museum on roller skates kind of day. Because we're going to go through this entire chapter 2 in one day and skip over quite a bit of the calculations. So, first of all, brokerage firm. We discussed these three on Tuesday. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Are you going to go with a Merrill Lynch or a Morgan Stanley or UBS? Probably not. They want you to have at least a few hundred thousand dollars. Discount brokerages, the mom and pop shops will normally deal with you. A.G. Edwards, Edward Jones. Schwab is the biggest discount broker. And then there are the internet brokers. There are the TD Waterhouse, TD Ameritrade now, Scottrade, and the others. What can you expect to pay from each? Well, commissions. Then and now, virtually all brokerage firms traditionally made their money from commissions. Full-service brokers expect to pay $70 to $100 or more per trade. Discount brokers used to start, and this was in the 1970s, at $45, then down to $29, then down to $19, $13, and I think Schwab is now charging $9 a trade. I think they are, which is pretty good, folks, for Schwab, because they don't... Yeah, I gave them out on Tuesday. You weren't here on Tuesday? You're right, you weren't here on Tuesday. Okay. Because I keep mentioning this, we're discussing options and selling options where you would... Yeah, the whole class. And then the deep discount brokers, $5, $7, up to $18 a trade. Now the mutual fund companies are getting into the act. Fidelity started with their own brokerage firm. Vanguard has a brokerage firm now. They offer free commissions on their own funds, on their own ETFs. So you could buy an ETF, exchange-traded fund, not pay any brokerage commission. A couple of companies experimented with $0 commissions. Huh? How did they figure that one out? Well, the first one failed. The other one now charges $5 a trade. Wait a minute. How can a brokerage firm make any money with a $0 commission? In fact, how can any company make money with $5 or $7 per trade? Do you remember this slide from Chapter 5?
Yes.
What are they doing, folks? They are redirecting your orders to particular broker-dealers, market makers, market centers for execution, and they're getting a kickback remuneration. And they do it all uppercase, and with, you know, to Scotch Trade's credit, at least they send you this email every single trade confirmation, even though people don't know what they're reading. The others don't even bother. You sign that, you clicked here to say that you read the agreement, and there it is. To my understanding, Schwab does not do this. That's my understanding. What? You ask them directly. So you're using Schwab?
Yeah.
Cool. And how much do they charge if you do talk to a broker? An extra $25, right?
If you talk to someone, it's $25.
On top of the $9.
Yeah, if they come $8 for trading.
$8 for trading.
They will only charge $25 if they commit trade for you. If they don't take trade for you, they can walk you the whole entire way. And if they click trade, you can't click $5. If they don't click the trade and you click it, then they don't pay commission.
Wow. Okay, Schwab. Good for them. Good for them. Good for their customers. You see what you're saying? The other internet brokers, if you talk to a broker, they're going to want money because these guys get paid, gals get paid. So they'll charge an extra $25, $30 or whatever. Schwab is saying, we'll walk you through it. We'll talk to you about your... I'm thinking of buying McDonald's. What do you think? Well, it's a great company. Do you have a long-term perspective? Yeah, I have a long-term perspective. Yeah, I'd buy it. Look at how well they've done. Or whatever, you know, whatever recommendations they give. And they want to be paid for that. He's saying that Schwab is saying, as long as you go ahead and do the execution, we'll give it to you for free. Great, great. Okay, now, traditionally, commissions were how brokers were paid. But now there are alternative methods of paying for your broker. As the competition for your business has gotten fiercer, the methods of charging investors for investment services have gotten more, shall we say, creative. Merrill Lynch experimented with charging $3,000 per year for unlimited trades. So you pay them $3,000 a year, you can make as many trades as you want. That's gone. There are many other methods. The new modern-day agogo way to soak customers, charge for brokerage services, is called wealth management. And remember the Class F shares for Class F, Class FI, Class I for mutual funds? You had the mutual fund charging you an amount, and then the brokerage firm charged on top of that. It's the same idea. A wealth management account, sometimes called a wrap account, a financial advisor account. Instead of charging per transaction, the brokerage firm taxes on a yearly 1 or 2% wealth management fee. These types of programs are being pushed by all the major full-service brokerage firms, and there are many flavors of this program. The latest wrinkle to this method is called the new performance-based wealth management. Performance-based wealth management. Only pay your advisor when you make money. Your advisor receives 10 to 20% of your earnings when you make money.
Wow. What?
Wait a minute. When you go ahead, come on in, sit down, will you? The advisor receives nothing when you lose money or do not make anything. It is a variation of the way that hedge funds charge their shareholders. And these were really popular just a few years ago until the 2008-2009 debacle. In other words, hey, folks, you're not going to pay anything if you lose money. If you gain, well, we take 10%. We take 20% of that. Although it's, and here's one of them, I'm listening to this, and these guys, they said, well, we only want customers that can write a check for $1 million. Congratulations. Although it sounds tempting, the reality is how you have the potential to pay far, far more for your investment services, especially if you're the kind of person who wants to buy McDonald's and hold on to it for 20 years. because you're not buying and selling and buying and selling. If you're buying and selling and buying and selling, maybe this will work out about the same. But if you're buying and holding, this is going to cost you a fortune because they're going to be pulling money from you all the time, not just when you buy and sell. You with me? You understand? Okay, so I went to their website just recently. They are now charging a nominal fee even after two whatever quarters or something consecutive because they lost their shirts after 2008. I mean, all their clients went down 30, 40, 50% or more, and they didn't charge them for 4 or 5 years. Well, they changed it, and now they charge a minimum amount. How about no brokerage firms? Can you get away with not having a brokerage firm?
Sure.
Do you remember the dividend reinvestment plans we talked about? Where you go directly to McDonald's or IBM or Procter & Gamble and you say, I want to invest directly in your company through dividend reinvestment plans. Go on their website. It'll say investor relations. And they say, great, because they love these kind of investors. They love investors who are going to buy and hold. These are people who are actually owners of the company, not renters of the stock, buying it and selling it, buying and selling it. So you go through the mutual fund, not mutual fund, the company itself. Now, they don't do it. Somebody else does it for them. CompuShare is one of the big ones. And they're either free or very close to free. We saw the FDG&E one where they charge you 9 cents every few months or so. And then there are companies that will do it for you. They will aggregate your drips for you. Drips are low cost, yes, they're very cool, especially if you're buy and hold. They reinvest the dividends back in more shares like a mutual fund. But how do you like to sift through 18 different statements? Okay? That's not a big deal. I mean, it's not a big problem, but some of these places will charge you $10 a month to aggregate all your drips, and many brokerage firms now offer them. Yes? Yeah, in other words, if you had 18 different companies. And folks, these are mostly large cap dividend paying companies like Clorox and Kimberly-Clark and really boring companies that have been around for 50, 60, 100 years. Jet, Blue Chip, Johnson & Johnson.
How are their prices compared to going
to the stock exchange or NASDAQ? Well, in other words, you're going to get paid, you're going to get charged almost nothing.
No, but what about their stock price?
Oh, you get the same stock price as anybody else gets. Yeah, you get the market price. They're not making commissions. They're just allowing you to buy their stock and instead of taking the dividends in cash, you're buying more shares. Go back to chapter 5. Look at the drip. Look at the example of the drip. The San Diego Gas & Electric Sempra. Yeah, I think they're great. I think they're great personally.
Yeah,
not anymore. No, I used to, but not anymore. I know. People look at me. I don't have. I'm concentrating on real estate now. I apologize, but I don't have any more individual stocks. Everything's in mutual funds. I sold all my stocks to buy the first property, and I keep telling myself, I gotta get back. I gotta put a few $1,000 in, buy a few. Oh, I'm dying. I gotta deal with the dark. No, that's going into the mutual funds. I'm not stopping putting into the mutual funds. Folks. I'm still putting. I practice what I preach. I'm still putting money into the mutual funds. But no, I gotta get the. Right now we've got. What do we gotta do? Gotta get the heater's not working. I gotta get the heater working, and the windows are on order. They should be coming in today or tomorrow, and they gotta be replaced. I'll tell you. Stock. You gotta fix it. No, it's that heater. But want to fix it? Want to fix it? No, it's from the real estate. It's the real estate. What? I know. I'll tell you, folks. Stocks, mutual funds, stick with them. Real estate is a. Remember the PETA factor. Remember that we talked to you about the PETA factor with mutual funds? Pain in the... Well, real estate is a royal pain in the... Right. Okay, now, let's quickly. Come on, we got time. We can do it. A cash account is a brokerage account in which all transactions are made on a strictly cash basis. Cash accounts are the simplest arrangements, requiring no credit check of the customer by the brokerage firm. Once you've established a good relationship, most brokerage firms will allow you to purchase shares of stock, even if you don't have enough cash in the account. In other words, you're saying, oh, wow, this is a great price. I want to buy some Procter & Gamble. But you don't have enough cash. When does the transaction actually close? Remember that from Chapter 5? When does the stock transaction close?
3 days.
So you have 3 days to get the money in the account, because even if you buy it today, you ain't going to own the stock for 3 days. Mutual fund transactions clear in one day. Bond transactions clear in one day. Stock transactions clear in 3 days. So you have 3 days to get the money in the account. Now, the deep discount internet brokers, like Scottrade, they don't allow this. If you don't have the money in the account, even though you don't need the money for 3 days, you can't make the transaction. But you're, I don't know if Schwab will do that. Probably not, unless you have a personal relationship with one of the brokers. Okay, now, that is the way you should do your business, folks. That is my recommendation. But there is a whole other way of buying securities. Let's talk about stocks, but you can do it with bonds too, not mutual funds. And that's margin accounts. A brokerage account in which, subject to certain limitations, you can buy and sell the securities, the stocks, on credit. Borrow money to buy a security. If you open up a margin account, the brokerage firm will do a credit check, just like a bank or a credit union would do a credit check to make sure you're credit worthy, because you're going to be borrowing money for them. The interest rate you pay on money borrowed is called the margin rate. And they got it all balled up, if you ask me, but that's wait till we go through. This is the margin. And for me, the margin is what you borrow. No, not the way they figured it out. The margin is what you put up. As we'll see, the margin rate is the interest rate that you pay. And folks, it's actually a pretty darn good interest rate. It's usually about 1 or 2 percentage points above prime, which is pretty good. You know, it's not quite as good as a home equity line of credit, but a whole lot better than a credit card. And right now, you can get car loans for dirt cheap, but usually it's better than credit than car loans. So it's not a bad interest rate that you're paying. Now, the buying on margin allows you to perform margin trading. Buying on margin, leveraged account. There's that word again. The use of borrowed funds to purchase securities. It magnifies your returns by reducing the amount of equity that investor must put up. And the margin is the portion of the value of the investment that is not borrowed. Now, I have a problem with this. When I think of the word margin, I think of it the other way around. I think I put up this much, and then they came up with the margin. No. And you have to learn this, okay? Because I'm going to ask you on the back. The margin is how much you came up with. The amount of equity stated as a percentage. So you came up with 75%, they came up with 25%. Why should you buy on margin? Well, buying on margin allows the investor to use financial leverage. There's that word again. The use of debt financing to magnify or your investment gains or your investment losses. Buying on margin also allows an investor to tap into the equity of their account without actually selling the investments and generating the commissions and the taxable transactions. So if you think of a home equity line of credit, there's cash sitting in your house. There's equity in your house. You can use that home equity line of credit to borrow from your house. Am I saying you should?
No.
No, you do it in case of an emergency.
But not a pawn shop.
It's kind of like a pawn shop. I mean, not as bad. The interest rate on pawn shops can be 60%. The interest rate here right now is going to be 4 or 5%. All right? So it's not going to be that bad. Buying on margin is much like buying a house. When you purchase a house, you don't come up with the whole $300,000. You come up with a 10 or 20% down payment, right? In stocks, you have to have 50%. So the margin requirement is the initial margin. It's how much you have to come up with. And that is set, believe it or not, by the Federal Reserve Bank. And they can change it, but since forever, for decades, it's been 50%. Now, your firm, your brokerage firm, might look at your credit and say, we're not lending you 50%, we'll lend you 25%. They're allowed to do that, but they cannot lend you any more than 50%. You must put up 50% of your own funds. And this allows you to, yes?
Okay, so let's say you borrow $50,000, you put $50,000 of your own money, and the account got 10%.
Whee!
So you have to pay 4% of that
whole
amount?
No, only the amount that you borrow.
Okay.
And if you do go up 10%, it's actually as if you went up 20%. Hang on a minute. It magnifies your gains because they don't get to partake in the gain. You're the one who partakes in the gain. They just get the 50 grand. But hang on a minute. The margin loan, we're getting ahead of ourselves. The margin loan is the amount that, sometimes called the debit balance, that you borrow. So here's an example. And it's going to look too good to be true because it is. All right. You borrow 10 bucks and you put up $10. So I didn't use 50,000, I just used $20. And you buy a stock that's worth $20. Now, how much did you put up?
$10.
Here's your equity, and then there's the margin loan, the debit balance. All right? It should look equal. There we go. It looks better. Now, what happens if the price zooms up? Hey! It zooms up to 30. What happens? You made $10 instead of on a $20 investment. You only came up with 10 bucks, so you made $10 on a $10 investment. It magnified your gain. You see that? It's the same idea. Yeah, right. It's not as dangerous as options. It's not as dangerous as options, but it's the same idea. You use borrowed money as a lever to magnify your gain. You made $10 on a $10 investment. This is half of what you would have had to come up with if you simply purchased the stock outright with your own money. Instead of a 50% return on your investment, you received a 100% return on your investment. Yippee! Rock and roll. Cool?
It went down.
Okay. Well said. What? Exactly. Well, someday they don't go up and way up. No, it doesn't work that way. Sometimes it does, and then it usually goes down and way down. What happens if you put up 10 bucks, borrow 10 bucks, you purchase one share of stock for $20, but now the stock price drops to 10? What has happened now? If it drops to $10, you're wiped out. You still owe $10. You understand? You're wiped out. Instead of a 50% loss, you have a 100% loss. Oops!
Go down to like 9, then you will end up owing money.
They won't let this happen. They will not let this happen. Only half of the money was yours. You borrowed the rest. You've lost your entire investment. Buying on margin magnifies your gains and magnifies your losses.
How did you lose 100%?
Well, you borrowed the 10 bucks, right? This doesn't belong to you. This belongs to who? This is the brokerage firms. Your friendly neighborhood broker. And so this is how much you own. And if it drops 50%, your entire amount is gone. You remember the housing people? They put up 70 grand or 50 grand, and the price went from 600,000 down to 300,000.
10%.
Yeah, you still got to pay them back. You signed a contract, just like a bank or a credit union or a car loan or whatever. It's a loan. So, buying on margin was one of the major contributing factors to the crash of 1929. This new era, it's the modern world. At that time, the margin requirement was only 10%. Well, stocks were thought of now. You put up 10% for a home, right? So, hey, why not just put up 10% for stocks? The problem with that is that stocks are far more volatile than real estate. Real estate rarely falls 50%. You got to go back to the Great Depression and then go back to 2008. The next stop was 2008 when real estate fell 50%. At the time, I'll say, for this reason, they will not let you just do this. They will watch your account, and as soon as your account hits a certain amount, bingo, you get what's called a margin call. They're going to say, no, you've already lost enough. You've got two choices. You can come up with more cash, or we're selling the shares right now. And if you don't contact them and tell them what you want to do, they are allowed to do it for you. Yeah, well, you signed an agreement. Because margin trading is inherently more risky, margin accounts are more highly scrutinized by brokerage firms. A restricted account is a margin account whose equity is less than the initial margin requirement. It means you've started to lose money and your losses are being magnified. The investor may not make further margin purchases and must bring the margin back up to the initial 50% when securities are sold. So you're restricted, and it'll say on your account, restricted. You can't make any more margin purchases. If you're going to do any more transactions, you've got to bring yourself back up to this 50%. Information technology has made the brokerage firm's job of scrutinizing margin clients much easier. Now the computer just spits out a list of people who are in trouble. Okay, it's very simple. It's like, okay, get in touch with them. They're in trouble. The maintenance margin is typically cannot be less than 25%. That's the Federal Reserve Bank that sets that. But it could be more. Your brokerage firm might look at you and say, well, you know what? Your maintenance margin is 40% or 30%. And if it gets below this, you're going to get a margin call. A margin call is a notification of the need to bring the equity of an account whose margin is below the maintenance level up to the initial level, or to sell the darn shares because you're in trouble. If the investor does not meet the margin call in sufficient time, typically 72 hours, but it could be sooner, the brokerage firm is authorized to sell enough of the securities to meet the margin call. And there's an old saying, never meet a margin call. In other words, don't bring good money after bad. You've already lost, cut your losses, run. And in the 2000 to 2002 debacle, the bear market, when tech stocks lost 80%, companies like TD Waterhouse, which now is called TD Ameritrade, they weren't waiting. They didn't wait. These tech firms, which are many which are gone now, AOL and eBay and Amazon survived, but who else didn't make it? Northern Telecom, which was called Nortel. These companies disappeared, and their stock prices were plummeting. And so TD Waterhouse got in a lot of bad publicity from their clients because they sent out the email that evening. In the evening, the email was automatically sent out, and at the opening of the market, they sold the shares. They didn't wait for the investor to get back to them and tell them what they wanted to do. They just sold them. Because what happens if you start going into the negative territory and you disappear and send them a postcard from Aruba or Puerto Rico? Who's stuck?
They are.
The brokerage firm. Just like the banks were stuck with that real estate when people lost their entire down payments and then were down $200,000 or $300,000. Literally, their houses were underwater that much by the mortgage. Are you with me? Understand? Yeah, so they're gonna kick you out. They're not going to let you lose that much money. Of course, if your investments do well, then you can use the excess margin you create in your margin account to purchase additional stock without having to come up with more money. Excess margin is more equity than is required in a margin account, and this technique is called pyramiding. I hate that word. The technique of using excess margin from paper profits in margin accounts to partly or fully finance the acquisition of additional stocks or bonds or whatever. Let's talk about stocks. What do you think of this?
Yeah, I like being the chief.
He wants to sell the option. And then remember that it's a loan. They're charging you interest. Paying interest on the margin loan also adds yet another drag on your investment returns. Your margin investments must meet or exceed the margin interest rate in order for you to just break even. Because you're borrowing this $10. They're not giving it to you for free. Yes, sir.
I have a question.
Yeah.
If when you do this margining, as soon as the price goes up, you're okay.
Yeah. If the price is going up, you're great. You're making more money than you would.
Is it only when it goes down?
If it goes down, you could get.
Is there a time period for this?
No time period, but there's a maintenance level. There, if it goes below, the law says it. Well, not the law, the regulations. The Federal Reserve Bank says it cannot go below 50%. That's the absolute minimum. But your brokerage firm might look at your credit history, look at your account and say, no, we're setting it at 40% for you. So if it goes below 40%, you're going to get an email, you're going to get a friendly call. Hey, what do you want to do? You want to come up with more cash, or do you want to sell these securities now? Because you've hit your maintenance margin. So if it's going up, great! It's fabulous! But if it's going down, you're losing money at a greater rate than if you put up the whole amount. And they're not going to let you get down to this situation. It's not going to happen. Unless the stock fell overnight. For some reason, there was an accounting scandal or whatever. They were caught eating babies in the dark or whatever. You understand? That just it's not going to happen. They're not going to let it happen. They don't want it to happen because they don't want you to lose money and then disappear and not pay, because then they're on the hook for it. Commissions and interest. Now you know why your broker is always so happy to take your calls, right? Bend over. Here it comes again. Okay, so the question is, why would I buy on margin? And my easy answer is, don't. I don't think you should. The risks are not worth the potential reward, in my humble opinion. However, there is a valid logical reason for having a margin account. Say you need some cash, and you've built up a portfolio of high-quality companies, the companies we've been talking about, the name brands, and some of them you haven't heard of, but good companies. It allows you to temporarily borrow against your investments without having to sell them and incurring commissions and taxes. Right? If you sell them, the IRS is going to say, hey, you know, you owe us taxes. So you can borrow from them, but you have to pay interest. Yeah? Yeah, but think about it. Think about it. Once you now have $100,000 or $200,000 of individual stocks, not mutual funds, but you have this is your own account. You got the good high quality mutual funds in your retirement account, maybe some really good high quality stocks. But now you have your own account with, you know, mad money, whatever you want to call it. They call it mad money. And you want to buy a car. Right? And you're trying to get financing, but you haven't gotten it yet. So you can borrow from your brokerage firm, put down the down payment or whatever, and then get the financing and put the money back into your brokerage firm. Maybe you got a really good deal or whatever. Well, it depends. It depends on if you have IBM and Procter & Gamble and Johnson & Johnson and GE in your account, or if you have Butterfly.com or Flim Flam. What? Exactly. If you've got... No, you're borrowing from it. You're borrowing money from your account based on the equity in your account, based on the fact that these shares are worth something. Have you ever heard of a home equity line of credit? No? Okay, in 121, in the financial planning class, we talked about home equity lines of credit. You can borrow off the equity in your house. If you have a house that would sell for $300,000, and you have a mortgage, say, $200,000, your bank, your credit union, is going to let you borrow maybe, I don't know, I can't do the math right now in my head, but they'll let you $30,000. $40,000, they'll let you borrow from and buy a car. I don't think it's a good idea, but the roof needs to be replaced. The furnace needs to be replaced. That kind of thing. So the same idea. We have equity in our shares, and we can borrow from that equity. That's the same idea. I'm not saying you should do it, folks. but you're gonna if you take the Series 7, there it is, thank you very much. If you take the Series 7, you have to understand these. And so here are the calculations, and on the back of the handout I just gave you are some calculations that you're going to see on the Series 7. We're not going to do them, we're going to just blow right by them, and I don't even know if they've changed that much. Since when I took the exam, I looked at one of the books and they looked exactly the same to me. But there's a commentary, there is an answer key on the website, so if you are so inclined, yes. And remember, will these be on the exam?
Yeah,
no, they will not. You don't have to come Tuesday? You were here Tuesday. No? Okay, I'll give you another one.
Okay. It's from chapter 2.
Okay, so these will not be on the exam. Did you have one, Shannon?
Okay.
All right, now, that was buying on margin. Shorting. When we have been talking about buying stocks, we have been going long. Buying long. Long purchases. This is a transaction in which investors buy securities, let's talk about stocks, in the hope that they will increase in value and can be sold at a later date for a profit. This is the type of transaction that people commonly think of when they hear that someone bought stock. Buying long is the most common form of a transaction. You have an expectation of dividends. Yippee, we love dividends. Capital appreciation, or both. Buy low, sell high. You understand? That's a long purchase. And where did the name come from? I'm not exactly sure, but I think the idea is you're in it for the long term. You're going to buy it at 10, and hopefully it goes up to 20 or whatever. Buy low, sell high. Piece of cake? All right. Change your... Cambia de idea. How do you say that? Change your mind in Spanish? You say cambia de idea. To a day, change your idea. Don't change your mind, change your idea. Here's an example. You purchase one share of common stock for $20. The price rises. I used the wrong calculator. I'm sorry. I thought it was 20, goes up to 30. It goes up to $20, $30. You made $10 on a $20 investment. It's a 50% increase. Of course, if the price drops $10, that's a 50% loss. Yeah. The other way to do this is by selling short. Selling short. So buying long and selling, I probably should use red or orange because I want the thing to go down. Buying long, but I didn't. I used blue, so apologize. Shorting the stock, going short, selling short. The sale of borrowed stocks, their eventual repurchase by the short seller, and the return to the lender. It's the opposite of buying long. You are hoping that the price goes down. So instead of buying low and selling high, you're selling high and buying low. See, it doesn't matter what order you do it in. as long as you buy low and sell high. It doesn't matter if you buy low and sell high, if you buy low first and then sell high, or if you sell high and buy low. You can do it in any direction. You can do it forwards, which is the way most people think of it. Buy low, sell high. Or you can sell high and buy low. I lost you? Relax. Okay, hang on a minute. That's shorting. Selling short must take place in a margin account. So everything we said in the first part, first half hour, still applies. Because you are borrowing the stock. So we're going to do a credit check. We're going to make sure that your credit is good. You're not a flake. You haven't run off on debts in the past. Here's how it works. You borrow the stock from another shareholder without their knowledge. They don't know that you borrowed it. And sell it on the market. You receive money for selling stock that you do not own. Doesn't that sound illegal? That's illegal. You can't sell something that you don't own. Well, actually, you're just borrowing it. Remember? They don't know. They don't care. The brokerage firm takes care of all that. You wait for the stock price to go down. You then buy back the shares at a lower price and pocket the difference. The shareholder you borrowed the shares from never knows the shares were borrowed. The brokerage firm does all the financial sleight of hand. That's called the back office. They take care of that. By the way, if you sell shares you do not own and the company pays a dividend, you have to pay that dividend.
Oh, crap. Again?
If you sell short, say IBM, and IBM pays a dividend, because you've sold those shares, IBM no longer knows that this person owns IBM. So they're going to pay the shares to somebody else who you sold the shares to. So, but this person thinks, I still owe IBM. they're going to expect their dividends. Well, because you sold them short, you have to pay the dividends.
How do you know if somebody bought your shares?
You don't. The brokerage firm takes care of it. In fact, most brokerage firms, if you have your shares on account there and they sell them short for another investor, and then you say, well, I want my shares now, the brokerage firm will just go, no problem. They'll go out, they'll buy the shares on their own behalf and give them to you to sell. In fact, they usually have they have their own inventory. If they're, you know, well-known brand name companies, they'll just make sure that that happens. The established and full service brokers, probably Schwab will do that. But I know somebody who was in Scottrade, he sold some shares short. The investor wanted to sell their shares, who he borrowed the shares from, and so. Scottrade said, well, sorry, we've got to sell these shares. You've got to buy them back so we can sell them for the... And they just said, sorry. See, Merrill Finch would never have to do that. They would just buy them on their own account and give them to the shareholders. They said sorry to the person who sold the shares short and said, sorry, we have to kick you out. He wants his shares now. Because remember, you borrowed them. You got to pay him back. I like to... think of it in terms of riding lawnmowers. I don't know why I do, but say you have two neighbors on either side, Fred and Charlie, right? Fred and Charlie. And Fred just bought this beautiful brand new riding lawnmower from Sears or wherever, Costco. Not Costco, I guess it doesn't work in Costco. But you know that tomorrow it's going to go on sale for $250. Cost him $500. You know Sears is going to have a big sale tomorrow for $250. So you go to Fred, you say, hey, Fred, can I borrow your riding lawnmower? And he goes, oh, all right. And you ride it over to Charlie and say, Charlie, weren't you interested in one of these riding lawnmowers? Yeah, I was. How much is it? $500. No problem. I'll pay you to $500. So you just sold Fred's riding lawnmower for $500. Next day, it goes on sale at Sears. What do? You run down for $250, buy it, bring it back to Fred, and he says, ooh, looks cleaner than when you gave it to me. Perfectly legal. Well, I don't know the legality of that situation, but you signed an agreement that said if you borrowed the shares, you're going to buy them back. And they are going to hold you to that, just as if you borrowed money from a bank. What do you think the bank does with your money, folks? Do you think they leave it in there?
No.
No. They, what? No. No, they lend it out to other people. It's the same idea. So you borrow the shares from somebody today, you go and sell the shares in the market, get the cash, and then you buy shares later on when you want to close out the transaction. That's the term they'll use. They'll say close out the transaction. Hopefully the price has fallen and you've made money. If the price goes down, you've made money. If the price goes up, you've lost money. So it's a mirror image of how we normally think of buying and selling shares. Instead of buying and selling, we are selling and buying. As long as we buy low and sell high, it doesn't matter in what order we do it in. So here's an example. Here's the same, what color we got? Blue, right? Okay. Same example. We sell shares. We sell shares at $20, right? And we get that $20 because we sold the shares. Now, if the price goes down to $10, we buy the shares back. So we sell high, buy low, and we get to buy the shares at $10 and pocket the extra $10. You get to keep that difference. And now, congratulations. You just made $10 on a $0 investment? Something doesn't seem right. You sold these shares at $20 that weren't yours. Did you bring any money to the table?
No.
Something wrong here. You know, they're not going to let you do this. No. You cannot really make $10 on a $0 investment. It's a margin account. Remember the margin account? What's the initial margin requirement? 50%. The rules for a margin account still apply. You must put up at least 50%. People say, well, 50% of what? 50% of what you borrowed. Huh? I borrowed shares worth $20. I got to come up with $10. 50% of the proceeds from the sale of the borrowed stock. You borrowed the stock that you sold. Again, the brokerage firms use the account balance sheet that we didn't do a few minutes ago to keep track of the investor's margin. So examples follow. So now, what happens? What happens if you sell high and then the price goes up? Well, normally you'd be really excited. And you'd be, wow. Yeah, right. You received $20 from the sale of the stocks, because even though the stock was not yours, you borrowed it from somebody else, and now the stock zooms up to $40. You've got to now buy at $40 a stock that you sold at $20. And replace the shares. So you borrowed the shares, so I buy them back at 40, and I replace them to the person I borrowed from. So if the price goes up, I've lost money. Now over the long... Sweet, yes?
Well, you say you lost 20 on your transaction. Is 40 plus the interest that the brokerage...
Sure, you're paying interest on the amount you borrowed, right? So you're paying the and commission. Huh. Yeah, I know, brokerage firm. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so, what do you think of shorting? Yeah, I don't like it either, folks. You can lose a lot of money quickly. Plus, if you go back over the last 80 some odd years of modern finance, 90 years, for every 1 year the market's been down, it's gone up about 3 years, 4 years. That's the average. Now, you don't know which years it's going to be. But you see, you're trying to make money while the price is going down. It's a lot harder than trying to make money when the prices are going up, because in general the economy expands, the standard of living gets higher, we all do better, not all of us, but we're trying, right? So I stay away from it. When you buy long, you can only lose the purchase price of the stock. If you bought the stock at $20, that's it. That's all you can lose. Once it hits zero, you can't lose anything else. But when you sell short, is there any limit on how high stock can go?
No.
Hell no. There's no limit to the amount of money you can lose. Now, theoretically, what's going to happen? Exactly. You're going to get a margin call. The brokerage firm is going to say, no, this can't continue. You got to come up with more cash or close out the transaction. And there's an old saying, which I don't really think is very cool, but he who sells what isn't his'n must buy it back or go to prison. Now, we don't have debt. We don't have debt prisons anymore, but still, you
should.
How we?
So many people that are broke might as well be in prison.
At least you get fed, right?
Hey, look, if there was no ranking, that would be pretty cool. If there's none of that,
excuse me. Have you ever spent a night in a prison? I think you need to do it. I think you need to do a little bit of research. You need an archaeological dig or something.
You gotta go to federal minimum.
Some of them don't even have. Yeah, because these are people they're not worried about. They're not dangerous, and they're not physically dangerous. Yeah, real cool. Okay. Yeah, let's all. I don't know. I don't. Yeah, no. I think if you ever were to spend some time incarcerated, I think you would change your idea. Okay, the calculations are a little bit trickier than they were for the margining,
but that's
why we're skipping it. What?
The Stanford prison experiment.
What was the Stanford prison experiment? Oh, with the guards and they were all students. They were all students. But some people were said, you're the prisoners, you're the guards. And the prisoners started acting like prisoners and trying to get around things and trying to get over. And the guards started acting like guards and started being macho and wanting to beat them. Yeah, bizarre. So again, there's some calculations that you're going to do on the Series 7 that we're not going to do on the exam. But it shows what happens when you make money selling short or when you lose money selling short. And there's the formula to find out what the margin call price level is. And it's really not that high. So, for example, you sold 100 shares short at $20, and your proceeds are $2,000, so you deposited half of that, 50%. The maintenance margin is $25. If that stock price hits 25%, if you go down to 25%, they're going to hit you with a margin call. This is the formula. If that price hits $24, goes from 20 to 24, which is only a 20% raise, only with 20% rise in the price of the stock, you're going to get a margin call. Selling short is very risky, and the brokerage firm is going to keep a very close eye on you because you can lose a lot of money quickly. And what this creates is what's called a short squeeze. And what is a short squeeze? When the When the market is going down, what you'll see, those squiggles on the computer screen, you'll see this kind of thing, whammo, where there's a huge drop. Well, what's going on? These momentum buyers and sellers, they try to make money when the market goes up, they try to make money when the market goes down, they start shorting. And that just keeps pushing the price down and down and down and down because there's more sellers than there are buyers. Are you with me? But wait a minute. That's what people will say. Oh, it fell 5% in just a couple of days. So relax. Jump back up. Just relax. Relax. If you can't relax, you shouldn't be investing in stocks. Because what happens is eventually the short sellers have to buy it back, right? So they see the price start to tick up because they see other people coming in saying, well, these shares have now gotten pretty cheap. And you have this kind of thing. You have the subsequent up movement. It's called a short squeeze. The shorting pushes the market down further, but it's kind of like a compressed spring. It pushes it down artificially because these are shares that are being sold by being borrowed. They're not new shares on the market that the company has created. They're existing shares. But it artificially creates a greater supply. But that supply has to be sucked back up eventually. The short sellers have to come back and buy those shares. And so the subsequent up movement is often just as dramatic as the short sellers cover their positions. And what you'll see is the amount of short interest. The amount of short interest is the amount of stock shares that have been sold short. And this tells you what investors believe the future prospects for this in the short term for the stock are. If there are lots of short interest, if there are lots of short sellers, investors, we shouldn't call them investors, they're speculators, they believe the price is going to fall. Now, are they right? We'll see in a few months. If they're right, the price is probably going to tumble. If they're wrong, the price is going to do the exact opposite because they've got to come back into the market and buy them.
How are you able to see that
Well, you're not, but it happens so often. Let's take a look at what company you want to take a look at? What do you think is going to go down? Who do you think is going to go down big time? Let's look at Apple. And on the key, I'm going to hit the lights there, Dylan. On the key statistics page, we see the amount. Oh, wow. Wow, I would have thought it would have been higher. The amount of short interest as of April 15th was only 2%. Out of the 938 million and a half shares, only 20 million shares were sold short. So in traders, speculators, people who sell short are normally not investors. They might call themselves investors, but they're traders. They're speculators. They're not hold by definition, they're not holding it for the long term. They're holding it for the short term, short selling short. But that's a low amount. How about another company? Do you think it's going to be in trouble? Good choice. Good choice. Let's take a look at JCP and see how much shares are short. Ah, see? Look how much shares are short. There are, exactly, there are 219 million shares and 56 million of them are sold short. So right now, there's a 37% of the shares out there have been borrowed and sold on the market. So if JCPenney's goes down, those people are going to be looking like geniuses. But if JCPenney's hangs on, starts turning around, same store sales start going back up, they said, we are sorry, come back, we'll change our way, we'll send you out the coupons again.
But those people have to buy the shares back.
They have to buy the shares back.
So what's the amount of time that they have?
There's no time limit, but if the stock starts coming back, if the company doesn't look like, because a lot of people think JCPenney's by the end of this year is going to be gone. I don't think so. I don't really know retail that well. I hate shopping.
You're betting against the market.
You're betting against, if you sell short, you're betting that JCPenney's is going to disappear. You mall fan, what? Well, you're just betting that they're going to lose. You're betting they're going to lose. Well, and getting in the house, only, yeah, the house bets that you're going to lose if you're betting. So they're betting that JCPenney's. Now, any mall fans here? Any? What do you think of JCPenney's? That's okay, but what is your opinion? Do you think they'll survive?
Yes, I think maybe this year, yes.
Yeah.
I used to work with Jenny, and I saw a friend a couple of friends that work there still. I guess they're spending too much money to build things like changing the price tag, like they'll spend at least 50 hours a day just to change those things around, like see the salaries. I think they're going to have some kind of insurance division that's very profitable, that sells baby insurance. The company, when every time a child is born, it's public knowledge, and they scour the database and they send you something. Ooh, you're chubby.
Is it
any
like seasonal office?
You're asking the wrong person. Retail, my understanding is retail is very seasonal. They make most of the money during Christmas. That's my understanding. In fact, the reason they call it Black Friday is not because of the experience, it's because that's when they turn a profit for the year. That's when they go into the black from the red. That's my understanding. I'm the wrong person to ask about retail.
How about Blockbuster?
Blockbuster, I think, is already gone, isn't it? They've been purchased. No. I think they're not. I don't think they're. Blockbuster's already been gone. They disappeared.
What about Redbox?
But I don't know if that's public. I don't know. But do you understand now? Do you understand the difference? That's what I want to make sure you understand.
Yeah.
The difference is speculators, people who sell short, are not betting that Apple's going to disappear, but they're betting that JCPenney's going to disappear. Now, are they right? That's the question you have to ask yourself. And if you're cool, if you're good, if you're savvy about figuring out whether, you know, a company is going to survive in the retail business, and you felt that JCPenney's was... Because, I mean, they've been around for over 100 years. And my wife loves them. My wife still loves them. That's the place we go to. This is where I got my clothes. And we know exactly...
Definitely going out of business.
We know exactly what we drop. We go to the one door we drive to go to one door, either we ride our bike or drive to the one in Missing Valley, you know, Fascist Valley, you've been there. We know which door to go in. We run to the men's department. We pick out four or five things. Okay, we look at it, like, four or five shirts. Okay, try those. Okay, I like them. I hate this. This feels good. This is comfortable. Okay, buy four or five of them, and we run out. Because I hate shopping. I hate it. Macy's is owned by, who's it? What, Federated? Who's Macy's? I don't know. Is Macy's its own company? Macy's, M. They got M. Sears is part of Kmart, believe it or not.
Kmart was part of Sears.
Whatever, they're together. Dude, let's see Macy's. Do short sellers think that Macy's is going to fall?
No.
No, they're not betting against Macy's. So you understand that? Yeah, I hope so. Am I suggesting you do it?
Yes.
Hell no. No. Instruction about syphilis is not an instruction to acquire syphilis. And in 2002, the market, it had been like water torture. It really, 2000 to 2002 was like Chinese water torture. Like drip, drip, drip. 2008 was like a bolt of lightning out of the sky. You're going to just die. Well, the market just, in 2000 to 2002 just kept falling and falling and falling. Okay, so when's this going to end? It kept falling and falling. And in August of 2002, short interest in the market as a whole, in the New York Stock Exchange, New York Stock Exchange, was the highest it had ever been in the history of the United States stock markets. And I thought, okay, we're near the end. Because it can't continue. Because eventually these people have to buy the shares back. And in 2003, it continued for a few more months. And in 2003, the market came roaring back because it had to. Unless the world was going to end, and it didn't, thankfully. Now, actually, what?
Not what you think right now, or stuff?
You know, I don't know. Some people are saying, oh, it's like 1987, it's going to zoom right up. And of course, what happened again, 1987? I don't know. We'll see. But over the next 5 to 10 years, personally, if you put a gun to my head, I would tell you I am very optimistic about the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. In 20 years, we will not recognize the world. It will be so much. I mean, think about it. 20 years ago, the internet had not been unleashed upon the population yet. And the biotechnology world is going to make what we did with telecommunications and computers look tame. I mean, it's going to I don't know how, but it's going to happen. Yeah?
So, like, if you want to see the whole interest in some S&P 500,
I'm not exactly sure. I gotta look. That's a good question. I've been meaning to do that. Another good question. Look up SPY and DJIA and find out if you can get the short. Okay, I'm going to look that up. That's a good question. All right, now short selling. Actually, there used to be a valid reason for shorting a stock. Used to be. It's been gone since 1997. It was called shorting against the box, and don't ask me where they got that term from. But shorting stock that you already owned? Why would you do that? Well, it allows you... Yeah, short your own stock. It doesn't make any sense. It allows you to sell a stock without creating a taxable transaction until you close out the transaction with your own stock. So say you wanted to sell this stock and get the money, and it was December. If you sell it now, you're going to have to pay the taxes in April, or you got by the time you file your taxes in April. If you wait until January, then you don't have to do it until a whole other year. So what you would do is you would sell it short in December, get the money, and then in January, deliver the shares, your own shares. You have to buy them back. You already own them. You just give them to. You tell the broker firm, here's my shares to close out the transaction. The IRS, if you short a stock that you own, they treat it as if you sold it. So, since 1997. So, forget that.
It closed in 1997, but when did they actually. How long was it open?
Oh, it was done for decades. What do you mean, scam? You can disagree with a law or a regulation, and that's why we have the First Amendment. You call your elected bozo representative, senator, or poly means many ticks, or and you say, I don't like this. And they'll go, okay, thank you very much. Okay, last slide. Who wants to be a broker? Huh? Who wants to get in the industry? Yeah? Yeah? I'm telling you folks, they need people, especially if you're bilingual, ex-military, women, they need women. And I told you this already, the Series 7 is a difficult test, but it's not impossible. But the reason I brought this back up is we would have done, if we had taken 2 days, we would have done the exercises for options and futures, which we took a look at on Tuesday. We would have done the exercises for margining and shorting, and they are that's as tricky as it gets. If you can handle those exercises, then you can pass the Series 7. And that is our review of is our buying and selling securities. What do you think? Like it? Yeah? Don't do it. Don't. Maybe margin later on after you have a few $100,000. You're all going to do it. What? The reason I taught it to you is because you need to know it. You need to know it. It doesn't mean you should do it. I've never shorted a stock. Peter Lynch says never short a stock. And who am I to argue with Peter Lynch? He racked up 29% from 1977 to 1989. 29% per year. So, there you go.
What does it take to be a broker?
It's going to take you, I think, it depends on your studying habits, but it took me about 2 months of studying, about 1 to 2 hours a day. So every day I made, and I threw them away. I feel like an idiot now. I got like a ritualistic purge. But I had hundreds, I don't know how many, but I had hundreds of flashcards. Right? And you take the, I made lots of, I like to outline. When I study, I make outlines, so I outline things. And then these good books, and the good, now it's all software, it's all, you know, apps and things. Why did I do that? I should have kept them and lent them out, the most important thing is you take the practice exams, and you take them over, and you take them over, and over and over again, because the exam questions are, you know, basically boilerplate. And they will ask you certain questions over and over and over again. And that's the most important thing. And it should take you about 2 months, 1 hour, 2 hours a day. Well, that's a lot if you ask me. That's a lot. For most people, what they do, what I've noticed, is they often fail it the first time because what they do is they don't take these questions that I gave you from Tuesday and today. They don't take them seriously. They learn everything else, and they go, I can finesse them. But as you saw, it's like a mirror in options, a call option to buy, a put option to sell. Margining, right? And then shorting, you're hoping it goes down. No, I'm hoping it goes up. So you have to make sure you can do these. Because you have, there's, I forget how many number, maybe it's 8. But there are 8 sections. You don't see 8 sections. You just see 120 questions, an hour for lunch, and then 120 questions. But there are 8 sections, and you have to pass each section with 70%. Not the entire exam, each little individual exam that's inside the exam. And they will tell you, there are some questions that have nothing to do with the exam. They don't tell you which ones. They will tell you there are some questions that you are not being tested on. Even though it looks like a question. Wow. And I can tell you there were some things I didn't... Where the hell did this come from? What is this? I have no idea. I just... There's, my understanding, there's no penalty for guessing, so I didn't leave it blank. But I had no idea what the hell they were talking about. Oh, I can't even remember. Yeah, how much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? Yes, you have to be sponsored. Remember, they're going to do a background check. They're going to call the FBI. They're going to make sure that you are not a flake, criminal record, that kind of thing. Forget it. And the brokerage firm must sponsor you. But brokerage firms are looking for people. And I'll tell you, it's a great job. I love it. Now, I'm lucky. What?
What level of education do you want?
They want you to eventually get your bachelor's degree. Okay. You don't need a bachelor's degree to start. But they want, no, you don't need one, but they're going to want you to eventually get it. You're going to want to get it. You're going to want to get your...
No.
Which people?
Well,
The insurance folks, they will first get you to take your insurance license. They will steer you to insurance and see if you can sell insurance, which is boring and icky in my opinion. I have my insurance license.
I thought it was kind of different.
Eventually they'll sponsor you to get your series. They might sponsor you to get your series 6 first, which is just mutual funds.
After you sell
insurance to all your family and friends who don't need it.
Yeah.
Mutual funds. And the reason, series 7 stocks, bonds, limited partnerships, unit investment trusts, everything that's securities.
But no mutual funds.
No, mutual funds, of course. Yeah, mutual funds also. But the reason Series 6 is popular is because insurance agents will often want to sell what are called variable annuities. And variable annuities have mutual funds inside them. So they have to get, they have to be insured, they have to be registered by the insurance commissioner of the state that they're in. But they also need to be sponsored by the Securities Exchange Commission, FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, to sell mutual funds. So the Series 6 is a whole lot easier. It's just mutual funds. And if you are interested in insurance, that's one way to go. But I would suggest the Series 7. I like brokerage firms better, but that's me. Everybody's different. Insurance? Everybody needs insurance, folks.
I don't know.
Yes, you do. Do you have a car? Do you have a home? Do you have health? You have kids? All right. Next Tuesday, we will do real estate, gold, and other investment alternatives. Who's checking? Turn the light on, please.